I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Lindsay Wong joins me again. She's just published a new novel, Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies. It's often funny as well as horrifying in some parts. The book follows Lucinda Lowe, an MFA dropout living in Vancouver with six roommates and zero job prospects. She's got a heavy debt load and at the same time has to save her grandmother and sister. She might as well be dead, and to escape life, she's signed up to be a corpse bride, to be sold to the highest bidder. She's got training, which we follow her through, which she's got to prepare for being a bride in the afterlife. The book looks at the ghosts, real and imagined. We can't escape our past, and that haunts a lot of the book, especially in how Lucinda and the other characters comport themselves. I'll ask Lindsay about the book and the world of curses that she illuminates and illustrates throughout. It's fascinating to think one could curse somebody else and what that could mean for oneself in the present and the afterlife. The burden on women especially is something that one reads about in the book, and it's culturally imposed as well, which makes the writing of this novel subversive as well as engaging. Lindsay Wong is the author of the critically acclaimed, award-winning, and best-selling memoir, The Woo-Woo, which was a finalist for Canada Reads 2019. It won the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize, which, in full disclosure, I sat on the judging panel for. It was also long-listed for the Leacock Medal. In 2023, she published a short story collection, Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality, which she first appeared on the program with and was shortlisted for the Jim Diva Prize for Writing That Provokes. She's also written a YA novel, My Summer of Love and Misfortune. She holds a BFA in creative writing from the University of British Columbia and an MFA in literary nonfiction from Columbia University. She teaches creative writing at the University of Winnipeg. Visit lindsaywongwriter.com for more. The new book is published by Penguin. We spoke 1 week ago with Lindsay joining me from Toronto. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Lindsay Wong. Professor Wong, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I'm enjoying the book a great deal, and I like the fact that I'm being told this story by various voices, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's the, I guess, the main narrator, and then we hear from a certain character, as well as the narrator that we read in the footnotes, for example. In the footnotes, the narrator talks about early on about Chinese superstitions and how that might be regarded by non-Chinese readers. And then, as the narrator points out, you know, a lot of Western culture is also based on superstitions, you know, and anywhere from various religions to Santa Claus to the Tooth Fairy. The narrator from time to time talks in the book about the feedback from various readers and other academics, and I'm assuming that's not made up, and that's probably from some of your own experience, is it?
Mm-hmm. So that's very astute observation. I was wondering if anyone would notice. So the footnotes in the book, they're sort of my way of being kind of sneaky and calling out certain people. I have some observations about friends, colleagues, family members. So it's kind of like a test to see if they read the book. So if they tell me they love it, then I might know, like, you didn't read that footnote on page 64 or whatever. But I just thought, you know, as a writer who, you know, we say that, you know, as Chinese Canadians, we write from the margins, right? Mm. And so that was sort of my playful way of sneaking in something that may or may not get read. And I think it was really important for me to sort of address community through that process. So most people are going to be reading the main text, but they're going to be maybe skipping over the footnotes unless you know where to look. And then to address your other question about the Chinese superstitions, I just thought it was really important for me to tell the reader, I'm assuming the mainstream reader who is not familiar with Chinese customs,
sure,
that this is not a grotesque custom. I mean, yes, it is grotesque, but how different is it from believing in the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus? Mm. Because if you look at that, it's pretty absurd, and there's some Santa Claus retellings and Tooth Fairy retellings that can be a little bit discerning. And I don't want readers to pick up a book and say Chinese people are so barbaric and uncivil because they have this arcane practice, right? There's that tendency, I think, to stereotype Chinese culture.
Yeah, and I think when we stereotype these things, and I'm talking as an Asian, my parents are Filipino, mm-hmm. that it's easy to dismiss whatever it is that one can stereotype or say not take seriously.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Especially so much of BIPOC literature is told, is looked at through a harsher lens by white mainstream readers. They pick up the book and say, it's not for me because I can't relate to it. I don't understand any of these traditions, right? Whereas, you know, marginalized and BIPOC readers are expected to be comfortable with the Western canon.
Yeah, there's another footnote where the author talks about being told that they wanted their prose the prose to sound less ethnic or translation sounding. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you got for this book in particular, or was that something some previous writings say?
Not in this book. This was regularly told to me when I was in workshops, both at UBC and at Columbia. I did not have any BIPOC professors, and at that time, it was predominantly a white classmates and a white professor, and this was the feedback I would get. I would send in pages of woo-woo, at my first memoir, for example, and people would say, this sounds translated. This sounds really ethnic. And I'd be like, okay, but how and why? Is it in the syntax that you think doesn't sound white? Is it the culture? Is it the content? And that was a really interesting and I think harmful dialogue that happened.
Yeah.
And I think it really does, it stays with you. And so I think in some ways I'm sort of responding to that feedback and that criticism. Only if you read the footnotes.
Yeah, yeah. This idea of villain hitting, for people listening to this who haven't read the book yet, how would you define that? I mean, is that the same thing as putting a curse on somebody?
Mm-hmm. So villain hitting is this old Chinese voodoo. It took place it started in the Tang Dynasty, actually. And it's really, it's still practiced today in Hong Kong, and you can go under a bridge in Causeway Bay, and there'll be a bunch of aunties, and you bring them $50 Hong Kong, which is apparently $9 Canadian, I just found that out,
yeah.
And you say, can you please curse this person? And you give them a picture, and they take a shoe and a paper effigy with that person's photo, and they will hit it, and horrible misfortune is supposed to happen. And in the novel, Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies, Lucinda Low has a grandmother, Bo Chai, who is a villain hitter. And she can make horrible things happen to anyone. So she can make your genitals implode or maybe walk into traffic.
Yeah.
So anything can happen. So it's pretty gnarly.
And
I don't know if it works, though. Yeah. I've never tried villain hitting.
Yeah, I've seen videos of that on Instagram where people go to this place and they pay their money and then they do this. And the shoe itself, I mean, that has a great deal of meaning, doesn't it?
I think so. I think there's something I'm not sure about, like lotus feet. There's it's a really a symbol, I think, of woman's anger and repression. Taking a shoe and hitting something, of course, it's cathartic, I think. And I always see them use like a wooden slipper or some kind of sandal.
Yeah.
And then I guess in modern days, I'm sure people would use sneaker, right? Or maybe like in Canada, snow boots, something heavy.
Yeah, yeah. How old is Lucinda when we meet her in the book?
Lucinda's 30 years old. She's graduated with her MFA, or at least she's tried to. She's disgraced. And she's living in Vancouver with six roommates. And it was really important for me to show that, you know, who can make art in this society when it's so unaffordable, especially in Vancouver. I remember when I finished schooling, and even when I had my first book out, I was living with six roommates in East Vancouver, and I had to pay $800 a month just to rent this tiny, tiny room. I just don't know how people live these days.
And one of her roommates is a well-known artist, I guess, in the theater community, who has the same sort of living condition and you know, who's been written about in magazines and sort of profiles about them, right? I mean, that says something about artists, not just in this town, but I'm sure that's the same thing in big cities across North America, right?
For sure, and I think that's the really scary part. I was living in that house, and I'm sure Lucinda too, and everyone from 20 to 55-year-olds were living there. And, you know, in your 50s, and you can't afford to live alone, and you're an artist, and you're well-known, I just think it's terrible.
So when we meet Lucinda in the book, she's gone to China, and she's, I guess, training. There is some training involved into being a corpse bride. There are corpse grooms, too, is that right?
There are. So anyone in the novel who can't afford to live anymore can sell their bodies, become a corpse spouse. And so I guess we should define what corpse spouse is for the readers. So that refers to this ancient practice called Minghun, and it's like arranged death marriage. So people aren't allowed to die alone. And Lucinda goes to these coffin caves, and she says that I'm going to sign myself up, and if someone agrees to marry me, that auction money is going to go to my grandmother and sister. So she doesn't get anything, but so she thinks she's trying to save herself by volunteering or signing herself up for this horrible job. So I think it's a lot like the gig economy for artists.
Yeah, it says something about how she has to resort to that, because, I mean, she has to save her grandmother and sister, but she's also escaping, I guess, whatever life she has that's perhaps unfulfilling, right?
Mm-hmm. Unfulfilling, filled with poverty. I mean, it's not fun living with roommates and not being able to afford your rent. And I think there's a moment in the book where she says that she's more worth alive, more worth dead than alive.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really fitting about how we view artists and how we view, you know, art and people who want to make art, whether or not we're creative writing or in theater.
This comes up a few times in the book, how Lucinda views others. And it comes through, I guess, in her sense of what beauty is. She's often describing what she sees as attractive. And, you know, I was thinking as I was reading these sort of references that she makes when she's describing people, a lot of that is passed down culturally, isn't it? And it matters a great deal at the same time to her.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cultural references to beauty, because I think that's part of that the stereotype of being in a good Asian female. So someone who is meek, but delicate, someone quiet, subdued, someone with fair skin. So again, that internalized and external racism. And so that something that Lucinda can't escape. You know, she grew up thinking about what is beautiful and what is not, and she sort of has this on her mind. So, again, her value. She's always thinking about what is she worth in society, what is she worth, you know, whether it's a corpse bride or a writer. And I think for her, it's she understands that she has some value in the beauty that is that others perceive her, but she has no value outside of coffin training. Because she's a very much a failed MFA student.
So as I'm reading the book, Lindsay, I couldn't help but notice that as a guy, it's a lot easier for me to get through life than, say, a woman does, especially in this story. I mean, a young girl in this book already has a lot of obstacles in the way, a lot that are passed down, a lot of these challenges that are passed down. It's not a unique observation, I guess, that you're hearing on this book tour. But I mean, it is hard for young girls and women in this culture, I guess, right?
I think so. I think there's a lot of double standards, especially if you are marginalized from you're a woman of color. I think there's like that expectation of you have to be a certain way. And so much of Chinese culture, for example, is really patriarchal. There's this sense that you have to get married, you have to reproduce, otherwise you don't have any worth. So again, that adds to Lucinda's sense of shame and how she views herself, because she feels like she sort of failed at everything. She's failed at writing. She's failed at, you know, being a good Chinese daughter. And that's something I wanted to rail against. And she's sort of trying to figure out what does it mean in that book. And I don't know if she actually gets there, or at least, you know, she has this moment where you know, she wants to live, right? Because it's so much easier, I think, and maybe this is says something about me, but it feels almost like Lucinda can just lie down and die, right? I think that's what she wants to do because she thinks it's easier than trying to survive on the gig economy.
So the book goes back and forth from the present to her Lucinda's recent past, you know, growing up in Vancouver, growing up in Richmond, to her grandmother's experience from the 20s on. When you're writing about or you're writing in settings that are different from today, going back to the past, the recent past and the further past, is there a particular time that you enjoyed writing in, say?
I think for me, I wanted to really distance myself from the present. So I did actually draw on my experiences in Vancouver. I lived with my grandmother in New York after my MSA. It was one of those housing projects, and there was a lot of cockroaches. So I did draw on those physical details. But I also went to Hong Kong, and I did visit the Villain Hitters. And I visited a lot of museums. I did a lot of historical research. And I did something so freeing, I think, to really sit down and imagine, right? So you're, you know, among these old buildings and thinking about, you know, what would someone living here in the 20s be like, right? I mean, you know, you're thinking about having electricity, you're thinking about, you know, all these historical times, right? And what I wanted to do with the book, because there are the shifting points of views, I wanted to kind of show that choicelessness, right? And how intergenerational trauma kind of follows you. It's like a haunting, right? And so even though their lives are very, very different, you know, Lucinda is a millennial. Her grandmother, you know, ends up working for the tribe, and she's a villain hitter. And they both have really horrible things that happen to them, but they're both resilient. But they also have no choice, right? Things are, you know, sort of just given to them. And so you have to make that decision between something bad and something worse.
Yeah, again, back to that point, is, I mean, I'm reading this as a guy, and there are a lot more choices, I guess, for guys then as now than, say, women would have.
And, oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, I guess, the power relationship, that privilege, right? Even though, because I think, you know, Chinese culture, it's very patriarchal, it's very Confucianism, you know, family first. And women, especially Chinese women, are expected to, you know, keep family secrets, to keep the family together, to be mothers and wives and daughters. And if you step outside of that role, if you don't fulfill any of them, then, you know, you're sort of maligned and hated. And I think it's really interesting. If you go to Hong Kong and you see all these women who are villain hitting, and these are really elderly women, right? There's no one young there. It's not like a profession someone young would do. But maybe you know, if the artist economy was terrible in Hong Kong, you'd have all these artists doing it. but it seems like, you know, there are grandmothers who have no place to go, right? And or aunties. And, you know, that's their only profession, their only choice, right? It's to kind of give out that vengeance. And I think there's a lot of, you know, repressed anger and grief, right? You know, when you have all these things happening to you and you have no outlet for it. So there is villain hitting.
Yeah, I was reflecting on curses and revenge and, you know, why people would, say, seek a villain hitter. I mean, I guess people just want some sort of control in their life, right? But then, I mean, you know, greedy people, evil people can also go to a villain hitter and I guess, avail themselves of that service too, right?
I think so. I think there's nothing stopping an awful person, but you have to believe in it, right?
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere, though, you get really bad luck if you keep giving out curses. And and in the book, in Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies, Lucinda's grandmother, she keeps her beauty, right, because it's, you know, it's her worth, but she rots from the inside. So that's kind of a punishment for performing villain hitting, but I don't know about real life.
The other thing that because you mentioned intergenerational trauma a moment ago, a lot of the stories that are passed down in the book, I mean, a lot of them can be scary, and I couldn't help but think, you know, this tradition of storytelling makes it so much a part of the tradition, doesn't it? I mean, that these are things that are passed down for a reason and not necessarily, I mean, they're meant to, I guess, keep people in line to tell them what's good, what's bad, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many superstitions specifically around death, right?
Mm.
So if you do something horrible happens to you, and I was really inspired while writing it about Chinese hell. I don't know, like the 18 levels of Buddhism. So if you're a gossip in life, you will get your tongue chopped out. If you end up, causing dissent among family members and hanging you from a tree of knives, you'll just swing back and forth and get cut. So it's very brutal, but comedic, but also, you know, horribly hilarious. but it's really just a lot of, you know, you must follow the rules or you'll be punished in the afterlife.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I noticed about Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies is that it's also a very funny book. Knowing how to make the reader laugh, is that something that comes naturally for you?
I think for me, I've always been drawn to comedic things, no matter how dark or morbid or grotesque, because I think there's something so appealing in it. Because if you're writing specifically dark material or you're having something horrible happen to you, I always want to be able to feel sort of comfortable in it for myself. It's not so that, you know, we can make fun of something, but it's more of a coping mechanism for the writer. And I do that just so I can get through a really terrible scene. And then, of course, I think that hopefully that helps the reader get through it, because I think I read somewhere that I rather laugh than cry. I think I told someone that in an interview. I think it's a natural reflex.
Yeah.
Right. It's I think it's horrible to think these really dark thoughts. And yes, you know, there's death in here and there's life, but so much of it is funny, is a thing with hell and the absurdity, I think, of, you know, preparing to be, you know, a court spouse for someone that you've never met, right? There's a lot to play with there.
Yeah, even in some of the sort of rough or gross parts in the book, I found the humor just a great balm, I guess, after a scene where it's kind of horrifying. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's like a moment for the reader to kind of sit back and pause and sort of digest, right? And so it's not just a relentless amount of horror. And of course, I think I admire writers who can just make something so scary and devastating. But I always feel like I need to somehow giggle or laugh while something, you know, ridiculous is happening, because a lot of horror is absurd, right? A lot of it is, you know, this can happen, or the maggots, right? I think I really enjoyed writing about and describing the maggots. I did a lot of research on YouTube and I was like, oh, this is what it looks like. And I think it's morbidly fascinating to me, but also, it's kind of comical to see, you know, maggots coming out of someone. I don't know. I mean, not in real life, but on the pages.
Yeah, well, you know, as a reader, you feel like, you know, there's something crawling on you as you're reading some of those parts. the book, I mean, again, this speaks to how visual the book is. You also evoke smells so well. And I guess there's a lot of memory, isn't there, that's tied to smell, I guess, more than we'd like to admit.
Yeah, I think it's something that we don't really think about. We always think about visually or what something, you know, tastes like. Sometimes we think about texture, but I think smell is such a large part of storytelling. I think there's something to really be said about, you know, how a dead body might smell. That's the horror in it, right? I've never seen a dead body. I don't know what it smells like, but I mean, I just imagine like that rot, right? Because there's so much to play with that, with the setting, right? I would think like some people have really sensitive noses, and you open a fridge and you're hit with that food smell, right? Sometimes it's not pleasant. It really helps keep the reader in discomfort.
Yeah, you describe cabbage in various ways in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are smells that, you know, that automatically, you know, send you back as you're reading these, you know, how what good cabbage smells like or what bad cabbage smells like, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a very pungent sort of vegetable, right? And I just thought it'd be kind of comedic if they were only eating cabbage the whole time. Like, can you imagine? Just like, that's like my worst nightmare, just having to, you know, yes, I'm being sold to, you know, a corsa, but I have to eat cabbage 3 times a day. Are you kidding me? I think the worst is Brussels sprouts, but maybe I should have made it about Brussels sprouts, but cabbage is pretty bad too.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I like cabbage and I like Brussels sprouts, but I know how.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I don't mind it, but then it's the smell that I think throws us off sometimes, and especially when it's not prepared well, or you know. But I mean, again, it's as one reads the book, and you know, I understand where what a character is smelling, and you know how a person smells. I guess sometimes as well.
Yes, right? Can you imagine, like, that's also the physical horror of having to hold someone whose smell is terrible, right? Or that smell that's unpleasant to you, right? Because you're in such close proximity in a coffin. And so it's, again, that discomfort is part of the horror that, you know, it's surreal, but also very physical, I think, right?
You write, Lindsay, in the acknowledgments of, that you hate writing.
I do. I really do hate it.
I think that's refreshing to hear from a writer, a reader, to hear that, because I mean, I think we realize just what a lot of how hard a job it is and what a lot of work it is. I'm assuming that the students you teach also find that useful to remember as they pursue writing themselves. I mean, that's something I'm sure you tell your students, right?
I try to be as pragmatic as possible. Sometimes it lands, and sometimes, you know, some students are more delicate about writing. I think there's a certain like romanticism, I think, with undergrads. I think I had it too. You have this idea like, oh, being a writer is going to be wonderful. I'm going to wear pajamas all day, and you know, I'll just sit in front of my computer, and all the words will come. And that's not the case, right? You know, it's a lot of just a lot of thinking, a lot of research, and a lot of really solitary work. It's not just the words just don't come sometimes, and I think I've always been very pragmatic and real about that, and very blunt about it, right? Because, to be honest, like, if I didn't have to write, I'm sure I would, you know, if I wasn't, I would do something else if I could do something else. Like, I just want to eat snacks all day, right? But of course, like, the work, you have to do the work.
I like your Instagram because you're always showing us what you're eating.
I know. I'm very food motivated. I'm actually part lab. A lot of people don't know that about me.
especially when you come out here and I see some of the places that you go to, I have been known to figure out a place to go to that I haven't been to through your feed. So,
great. That's so funny. Cause I like really like the dim sum in Vancouver. No shit on Winnipeg, but you know, the food in Vancouver, right? You have to eat the Asian food.
Yeah, I've been to places in Richmond thanks to your feed. Your publicist Scott Sellers sent along with the galley of the book this sheaf of articles and interviews that you've done, and you know I've followed your work since even before the Woo Woo came out. Do you ever take the time to look back at these last few years?
I have not. I think for me, it's always just been. Even though I do write about the past, I write about history a lot, and I'm influenced by, you know, family stories, I'm always just thinking about what's tomorrow, what do I do next, and I haven't just sat down and been like, look at what I've done, because I feel like there's a lot more. I don't know, maybe it's at that fear of stopping, even though I say I hate writing.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading through it last night as I was preparing for our chat today. And, you know, seeing articles from early on and, you know, with the last collection when that came out, it's been a very busy few years for you, hasn't it? And I guess the thing that I'm wondering, Lindsay, is this what you would have wanted for yourself early on?
I think I never expected it, to be honest. I mean, I think having peer recognition is just wonderful. Like, I think that's just something so lovely. When someone who's also a writer or reader tells you that their work resonated with them, they don't have to love it, but it made them think about something or it changed their life. I think that's always like the nicest feeling. But when I couldn't sell the Woo Woo, for example, I've told other interviewers that I just wanted a book to put on my shelf. That's all I wanted, right? we didn't even have a launch for the woo-woo. It was just like, oh, I have a book now. This is wonderful. But I did not expect to have actual readers. Yeah. Because you hear, like I said, you hear stories of people launching a book and, you know, five people, including their agent, read it, right? And that's it.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm thinking about as I'm reading the book, because I haven't finished Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies yet, is that as much as it's about death, it's about immortality, isn't it? And I guess deep down, we want to, even when we die, we'd like to live on somehow.
I think that's very true. Because you hear about other writers calling their books book babies, right?
Yeah.
And it's almost like you're putting out part of yourself in that book, right? In every book, whether or not it's some parts are true, whether or not, you know, it's completely fiction. There's always an element of you or who you were at that moment when you're writing.
And so, what is it like now that this book is out? Because I already mentioned that you hate writing. Are you working on something else, or is the career as a teacher, is that filling your days so much that you find little time to write?
Well, I have no choice but to write. With this book, with Villain Hitting, I wrote it between 12 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it was sort of these midnight sprints where I was completely uninterrupted. And that's when the words just came. I found that during the day when I had to do emails, and I had to teach, laundry, and cook, I just couldn't, I just didn't have that, I guess, the stamina or the creativity to sit down and write a book. But when everything was done and the world was asleep, that's when my brain sort of came alive. That was interesting to me.
Do you think those dark hours lent to some of the more horrifying parts of the book, say?
I wonder, maybe my ancestors were speaking to me, or the ghost of Lucinda was saying, like, this is time, right? Because when I always say that whenever I finish writing a book, I never remember what I wrote, because it's sort of just that process of getting it down on the page, right? And then I'm on to the next project, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of, I'm well into thinking about the next book, and then I have to kind of go back and be like, oh, what did I write about? What's this book about? What did I want to say? Because I feel like I'm a very different person than I was when the book was finished, right? Because it's, you know, a couple of years. You've sort of evolved and changed your style as a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying it. As I said earlier, I've been a big fan for a long time. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
And thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope you think of Megget.
It's once I put the book down that I have to try to forget that part. You know what I mean?
So I did something right. I made you remember.
The website for more is at lindseywongwriter.com. The new novel is Villain Hitting for Vicious Little Nobodies. It's published by Penguin. It's author Lindsey Wong. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.